You could be anywhere doing anything, but you're hanging out with us, and we appreciate that. So wherever you're listening and however you're listening, we appreciate you guys for listening. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another exciting episode of the Game Plan Podcast. Alex Goodwin is my name. You can follow me on Twitter at Alex Goodwin TSM. Again, that's on Twitter at Alex Goodwin TSM. Kennedy Miller.
Yes, sir.
Where can they find you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at _KennedyMiller_. Again, that's _KennedyMiller_.
All right. So I have like a quick question, Kennedy Miller. From the times of 10 p.m. at night to 1 a.m., what are you typically doing?
Either on the phone with my girlfriend, watching a show, Netflix, Hulu, or I'm getting ready for bed if we get by 12, 12:30.
The end of my evenings tend to go like that as well. It's a lot of relaxation, things like that. You're winding down from a long day, right? You don't want a whole lot of stress. You don't want to be actually up handling business at that hour. But Shad Khan was up last night handling business, and he fired Urban Meyer at 12:45 Eastern. Like, my first thing is, typically we hear firings around, you know, 8 a.m., noon, 3 or 4 p.m. You know how mad you got to be to fire somebody during cheek beating hours? Like, he didn't even want to wait till the morning. That's how bad he didn't want to deal with Urban Meyer anymore. He's like, yo, man, I don't want to see your car out here in the parking lot when I show up in the morning.
Right.
So, like, what are your overall thoughts on Urban Meyer's tenure as the Jaguars head coach?
The thoughts that I have about Urban Meyer as the head coach of the Jags, you know, you've been calling me a lot more optimistic. And I guess I'm starting to see myself as being that. So I wanted it to work because it seemed good, even though we know the past record of college coaches jumping to the NFL has not been good. But I wanted it to work out. And I think as far as on the field football play, that's not what got him fired. Like, they were bad, but it was expected that they would be bad. What, they were 2-11. They beat Miami, who's kind of playing better now. And they beat Buffalo. So, I mean, we've seen first-year head coaches go through worse. All the other problems off the field are the reason why I was like, Urban, you got to go. Like, it was like once every 2 weeks. He's in the headlines for at a club with a woman after they lost. You know, at a bar, not a club, excuse me. Kicking a kicker? Are you kidding me? Telling, you know, his staff that, you know, you guys are terrible. I had a better record at Bowling Green than you guys did. You're the one who hired him, Urban.
You hired him. And those are coaches like Charlie Strong or Chris Ash and a lot of other dudes. They had previously worked for him at Ohio State or Florida.
Whenever you got a guy like Jason Brown from Last Chance U defending you and saying it's not that big of a deal, it was probably time for you to go, Urban. It was probably time for you to go. And it's a shame that it goes like this and it had to end like this for Urban Meyer, who, you know, is one of the greatest college football coaches of all time, won 85% of his games. And I wouldn't say that his legacy is tarnished, but this was just a bad decision from the jump if this is going to be how you are going to approach things. So it was time to go. It was time to go. Players were losing respect for him. He had no control over the locker room. It was time to get rid of him.
I kind of question if he ever had the players' respect in the first place.
Correct.
So, like, there's just a litany of things he did wrong there. So, like, you start off your tenure by hiring a racist, Chris Doyle, right?
And then, right. I didn't even bring up that.
So, you hire him, and then, you know, you get a whole lot of blowback from the general public and the Fritz Pollard Alliance. Then you walk that back and fire him, right? And you said your vetting process was, I've known Chris for years, and he's always been a great guy and all this other, you know, white guy, you know, boys club type of stuff. So that you start with that. And then you bring in Tim Tebow, who has not done a damn thing of note in a football jersey since I was in the 10th grade. And you hire him to play tight end, right? Tim Tebow goes out there, embarrasses himself in that one preseason game, and then Tim Tebow's gone. Then we've got him being horny at the bar with the sorority girl, right? The sorority girl that was just shaking her back. And then, you know, the team breaks the huddle, 1-2-3 grind.
Like, right.
They are so
right.
And then, you know, all the stuff comes out about last week of some of the folks that are on the staff quit their jobs to take college jobs, you know, and then the whole thing's with James Robinson. in which he benched James Robinson for fumbling, but then he tried to put it on, said, oh, no, no, James was having some health issues or whatever, whatever. He wasn't 100%. And then he tells another story. He's like, well, the running backs coach wanted to bench him. And the running backs coach and everybody else was looking like, what are you talking about? And then he finally says, yeah, okay, I was the one who benched him. And then here's why I think, you know, it really got bad for him. Most times in the NFL, the quarterback and the head coach are one and the same, like messaging wise. When you hear a message from the quarterback, it's essentially a message from the coaching staff. Trevor Lawrence said, we want James out there on the field. We think James gives us the best chance to win. That is explicitly saying, in no uncertain terms, that our coach is wrong here. He's tripping. And he did that publicly. Right. So, like, there are all those different things. To me, they kind of, I guess, it leads me to believe that he never had that locker room in the first place. And then there's the other part of, and you mentioned this, there were reasons to believe this wasn't going to work. Typically, when college coaches go to the NFL, there are differences in power dynamics. Like, the players get paid more than you do. And right. They're not just going to take you talking to them any sort of way. And then, on the other hand, like, the list of college coaches that have struggled adjusting to the pro game, whether it be schematically or whether it be, you know, the people stuff. In the last 30 years, I can only think of two college coaches that have succeeded in the NFL, and that's Jimmy Johnson and Jim Harbaugh.
Well, I've got the records for every first-time NFL head coach leaving college since 2000.
Okay.
2001, Butch Davis goes from the U to Cleveland. He goes 24-35. Steve Spurrier goes from Florida to the Redskins. He goes 12-20.
Oh, we can't say that no Nick more. Saban. We. The who?
The football team. My apologies.
There we go.
2005, Nick Saban from LSU to the Dolphins. He went 15-17. Bobby Petrino in 07 from Louisville to Atlanta went 3-10. Jim Harbaugh, which I would argue besides Jimmy Johnson had the most success, from Stanford to the 49ers went 44-19. Greg Schiano, we remember how that fiasco lasted, 2012. Oh, yeah. From Rutgers to Tampa Bay, he went 11-21. Doug Marrone, 15-17. Chip Kelly, 26-21. Your guy, Bill O'Brien, 52-48.
That ain't my guy. That ain't my Bill O'Brien. The hell it is.
I thought you was going to just let me slide with that.
Nah. And who did you? Were you about to mention White Privilege Hall of Famer Cliff Kingsbury?
Cliff Kingsbury, which is still going on currently, is 23-20. Matt Rhule is 10-19, and Urban Meyer went 2-11. Can we stop this experiment?
I think so at this point, because, and I think some of them flamed out or didn't work in the NFL for different reasons. I think for Nick Saban, it would have worked out had they have been able to get Drew Brees. I think that would have worked.
I agree with that.
I think even Chip Kelly had 2-10-6 seasons, and then it kind of all went downhill in Philadelphia, and then he had that one bad San Francisco with Kaepernick. Like, so right. It kind of went downhill for him. And I think in Philadelphia, Chip Kelly's issue was like the people stuff.
Right. Like, I agree with you. It's all of these reasons aren't the same for these coaches leaving, but you see a lot in college football that the phrase you use perfectly is just a different power dynamic. A lot of college coaches have egos. And that's why they're college coaches, because they are the program. It doesn't matter what you do. I'm going to end up getting another 4 or 5 star if I'm at a blue chip program. But in the NFL, I'm at the bottom of the chain now. All the players make more money than me. I'm the one that goes out first if something goes wrong. So you have to be a special type of coach to be able to carry that ego in a college environment and then be able to tone it down a little once you get around players that, because the NFL is about stars. I mean, the NFL has stars. You're not going to be the star in the NFL. So you're going to have to realize how to walk around with not being the big man on campus anymore. And I think Jimmy Johnson did it well. I think that, Jim Harbaugh was okay. You know, like he was okay with it. He still had a little bit of ego, which is why he kind of flamed out later on. But a lot of coaches really struggle, and the way that they talk to players is one way to talk to 18- to 22-year-old that hasn't really had much, is really trying to get to the professional level, is not getting paid at that point, versus talking to a millionaire that, you know, has a wife and kids at home. And so I agree with you on the Nick Saban point. but also reading it, it was like some players like, you're not going to talk to me like you did at LSU. Like, we not the same. We not on the same level. You can't yell at me like that, which is why a guy like Bill Belichick has really made his money in the professional ranks, because he's not really a yeller and a screamer. He's just, you know, a lot of people say like he's sarcastic. He'll be sarcastic, but he's really just like talking to these guys and really teaching them and explaining.
Yeah. I was also thinking about like the aspect of even like roster building, aside from the totalitarianism of college football, where the head coach is effectively the athletic director, is not his boss. Like on the organizational chart, it'll say athletic director, then head football coach. But this is flipped. Like most times people hire an athletic director and a head coach, they're in tandem. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever the head coach wants, essentially, he's going to be able to get from an athletic director at a big Power Five school. But also from like a standpoint of like roster construction in college football, you can hoard as much talent as you want. I mean, of course, there are some scholarship limits there, but
right.
There's not a salary cap like there is in professional football. In professional football, the salary cap kind of prevents one team, in theory, from, you know, being able to monopolize high-end talent there. And I think, because I think we talked about this a couple weeks back, that health-wise, I didn't think Urban Meyer was going to do very well. Like, if we remember, Urban Meyer was having serious health issues at Ohio State, serious health issues at Florida, and they were on the top of the college football mountain.
Yep.
And now he goes to the Jacksonville Jaguars, a rudderless organization. Like, how is this going to work for him? And, man, did you see the way he shook Mike Vrabel's hand at the end of that game this week?
Yep.
Like, aside from him looking like he was high on Valium.
And didn't Mike Vrabel used to work for him?
At Ohio State, yes.
Yep.
So, aside from Urban Meyer now being gone, so who do you think the Jaguars could get to replace him?
Some of the names that, you know, have been seen floating around, Byron Leftwich, played in Jacksonville, obviously has worked with Brady over the past couple of years and has some success as an offensive coordinator. So I think he should be front runner. Then got Eric Bieniemy. Was it you that said that they should hire Jim Caldwell?
Yep, Jim Caldwell.
I brought that up because I just saw a tweet about him, how the Lions haven't had a winning record since they fired him. Who else am I thinking? I think those are the only three so far that have came to my mind. I saw like a Kellen Moore rumor. For Jacksonville's sake, I don't want Kellen Moore to be a head coach for them. He just hasn't shown enough to me yet. So
I mean, he doesn't have to really show a whole lot. He's young and he's white. Like I told somebody this a couple weeks ago. I said if Eric Bieniemy looked like Kellen Moore, he would have had a job 3 years ago. I think that's the size of it. But I think Jacksonville has got to ace this hire. Like there's no way around it. They have a generational talent at quarterback in Trevor Lawrence. Think about Peyton Manning or Andrew Luck. And now we've got Trevor Lawrence. You cannot mess this up. Potentially, Trevor Lawrence's career trajectory is at stake with this next hire. So
right.
you have to nail this. You have to hit this one out of the park. I saw something today and it said that Jacksonville has only won 6 or more games once in the past 11 years. One wow. time. And I think they cycled through 3 or 4 coaches in that time span.
And that was an AFC championship game. I mean, year, right?
Yep. 2017. Before that and after that, futility. So they can't afford to mess this up. And the reason why I said I think Jim Caldwell will be the best person for this job is that Jim Caldwell helped coach Peyton Manning some of the best years of his career and definitely had Matt Stafford during the best years of Matt Stafford's career. Right. Those are two dudes that swear by him. I know we always talk about these white guys like Adam Gase or Josh McDaniels being quarterback whisperers and all that other good stuff. Hey, man, Jim Caldwell, one of the most well-respected guys in the NFL. And most importantly, for the Jacksonville Jaguars right now, he won't embarrass you, which is very, very important. So
it'll be interesting because, I mean, like you said, it is very imperative that they get it right for Trevor Lawrence. And I would, if I was a offensive coordinator, I would kind of be chomping at the bit to get, you know, the number one overall pick in the draft, a chance to work with him and kind of mold him in the way that he needs to be molded to be a solid quarterback in this league. Because I think there are some tools that are there, but he just needs work and maturation and things like that. So, I like I said, my number one choice for them would be Byron Leftwich, just because he played there. He's shown to have some success lately as an offense coordinator. I know he's working with Brady, but if you're going to keep hiring Josh McDaniels, you might as well hire Byron Leftwich as well.
We're going to leave it right there. But we will be right back with more of the Game Plan Podcast on the other side of the break. Coming up next, the number one recruit in the country signed with Jackson State. Is this the start of a trend? I'm not so sure. And I'm going to tell you why when we come back. This is the Game Plan Podcast. Don't go too far. All right. So National Early Signing Day was yesterday and possibly the, guess you can say, the biggest recruiting coup in the history of modern college football was pulled off by Deion Sanders and Jackson State when they flipped the number one recruit in the ESPN 300, Travis Hunter, from Florida State, Deion's alma mater, to Jackson State. And this is the first player since the ESPN 300 rankings began in 2005 where a top 300 player committed to an FCS school, most specifically a historically black college and university. So, Ken, do you think this is going to start a larger trend of high-end 4- and 5-star black athletes going to historically black colleges and universities?
It was definitely noteworthy because he did it. I don't know if it will, how much it will impact other historically black colleges and universities. I think Deion Sanders has the appeal to kids because of who he is. He has the appeal to kids, parents, uncles, because of who he was as a football player and how charismatic he was. Also, his selling point, which I've heard him talk about before, on he is one of the best players to, best coaches to educate you on how to use an NIL, because he was a player himself that was getting paid in college, getting a Major League Baseball contract while still playing for Florida State. So I don't know if it's going to have an impact on every historical black college. You're starting to see more guys from the NFL realm are going to HBCUs. Eddie George at Tennessee State last year. Hugh Jackson just got hired at Grambling. And then, of course, Deion Sanders at Jackson State. But I still think that we have a ways to go as far as a mass group of kids, especially 4- and 5-stars, choosing HBCUs. But I do think that it was a nice step in the right direction, especially for him having committed to, or if thoughts have been committed to, Florida State for so long and then flipping at Jackson State at the last minute.
So I'm kind of with you. I'm very, very skeptical. And even more so, I've been kind of telling people the last 24 to 48 hours to kind of pump the brakes on this, right? That I think this was a unique case and it took a unique confluence of events, right? So it took Deion Sanders being there, right? And Deion being having the cult of personality that he has, along with what's been, I guess you could say, rumored throughout the college football media landscape as a pretty significant NIL deal with Barstool and Penn Gaming, right? Without either of those, I'm not sure if this happens. So, and I think what a lot of like historically black colleges and universities are trying to do now, they're trying to, some people are calling it the Deion effect, and I don't think it's going to have much of a long-term, you know, lifespan, because Eddie George doesn't have that same sort of cult of personality. Ken, your sister goes to Tennessee State. Does anybody give a damn that Eddie George is the coach there?
Nope.
Hugh Jackson just got, like you mentioned, just got the job at Grambling State. On the football field wise, all right, this is really going to help. He's, you know, a lot of people, well-renowned quarterback guy. On the field, that helps. But Hugh Jackson, by all accounts, has the personality of a brick wall.
Right.
Prairie View A&M, my alma mater, is rumored to be in the hunt for, well, is in the hunt for a new head coach. And they have been in contact with Kevin Sumlin. Now, Kevin Sumlin has been a prolific recruiter at Texas A&M, at University of Houston, at University of Oklahoma, right? But he just doesn't have this cult of personality, so to speak, right? So there's that aspect of it. And then the second part of it for me is if and when Deion Sanders leaves, because Deion Sanders has been very vocal about the fact that he would like to be a high-level Division I head football coach. He's already interviewed for the jobs at TCU and Colorado State. He didn't get those jobs, but the story is he interviewed very, very well. If and when he leaves, does this stop? Because if he leaves, what happens to Jackson State then, right? Do they continue to get these Division I transfers from University of Miami or Houston or Florida State? Does that stop?
I would say most likely no.
You don't think it stops?
I'd say like most likely it does stop.
All right.
They won't get there.
Right. So that's why I'm not as bullish or not. Like, I'm excited. Like, would I love for Willie Simmons at FAMU to get some 4- and 5-star players? Sure. Would I like for Prairie View to get a couple of 4- or 5-star players? Absolutely. Right. Would I like for, you know, Hugh Jackson to get him a couple guys? Yeah, it would be pretty cool. But do I think there's going to be a mass exodus? Nah, not really. I don't see.
No, I mean, I totally agree with that premise. And then with the sport being football, it is, I think it is a lot tougher. You know, basketball, if you get one guy, you know, like, you know, if he got a Zion Williamson, you know what I mean? That could change the landscape because of how, you know, it's only 5 people on the court at the same time. This guy's not wearing a helmet. He's very well known for his athleticism, so on and so forth. But with it being football, this guy being a cornerback, you know, he's a number one recruit in his class. But, you know, say he just turns out to have a good college career at Jackson State and say Deion stays all 4 years. How much of an impact does that influence the next guy who may be the number one quarterback to say, oh, I want to go there? Because if there's nothing that keeps popping, oh, this guy was the number one player. Look at him get, you know, 3 picks this past Saturday. Or look at him, you know, run back a 100-yard interception. Then, you know, how long will the pizzazz still stay there? And like you, I want it to happen. I like all those guys. From what I've heard, I like Hugh Jackson. I've watched him on I'm Athlete. I think he was on a season of Hard Knocks. I like his personality. I hope it works out. I definitely love Deion. I'm rooting for him. I'm rooting for all of them. But just to understand how far they are in terms of catching up with some of those schools as a whole, like the SWAC as a whole and HBCUs as a whole versus where 4- and 5-stars usually go. I understand there could be some similarities between lower level D1s and HBCUs, but where those guys are generally going, Clemson, Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, it's going to be extremely tough.
And I was going to say, like, this is a topic near and dear to my heart because, like, the listeners that don't know, I went to Prairie View A&M University. My father teaches at Prairie View A&M University. My mother teaches at Texas Southern University. I spent my formative years running up and down the Tiger Walk at Texas Southern. Been around the Labor Day Classic, you know, Bayou Classic, all of that. Like, I grew up in it. And I would say one of the big things that people have always asked is, How and why did all of the black players leave? How did they end up at all the big schools? Well, post integration, everybody, like once guys didn't have to just be at Southern or Grambling or Jackson State or Florida A&M or Bethune-Cookman, they went to the bigger schools. I was going to say the thing that now that some of the bigger schools have to offer is in the NIL realm. Now there are some HBCU athletes that are, you know, getting some NIL money and things like that, but we don't have the booster class to put up for serious NIL dollars. Like the things that University of Texas and their boosters are doing, giving $50,000 per year to all of these scholarship offensive linemen in a 4-figure stipend, I believe per month to the tight ends and the H-backs, right?
Right.
That's not money that black people just have to throw around, right? Black people just on the whole, like not to get, become this, I didn't want this to become like a sociology lesson, but like with black white racial wealth gap, we don't have like tons of disposable income. Like we don't have $50,000 to put towards a weight room. We don't have $45,000, $50,000, $60,000 to give to a 3- and 4- or 5-star tackle from Westfield High School. That's not money we've got. And I think one of the big things with Deion and Barstool being able to give this kid, I believe it was the number I heard was $2 million. Like, if we really think about it, and the number I've seen is that Jackson State's entire athletic budget is $8 million. Right? So, if a lot of the other historically black colleges and universities, you're going to want to have to come to a historically black college and university because you want to be here. Because we just don't have the NIL dollars from the boosters just to be thrown, like, to I don't want to say coerce you to come. But isn't it like you're not going to come because you got $2 million on the whole. So, I don't know. That's just like my handful of thoughts on that. You got anything else on that?
even though we both kind of agreed, I think we both agree on this as well, that we want the historical black colleges, we want the SWAC to continue to get players like this, like, you know, kids that are watching, high school kids, athletes, whoever it may be. I want you to actually do your research on these educational institutions and what they can do for you, and not just what they can provide you on the football field or on the basketball court. So I unfortunately did not go to HBCU. If I probably could go back, I would, even though I did enjoy my college career. But I would implore young adults, young kids that are getting ready to go to school, and especially to take your talents somewhere, to really look into these schools and do your due diligence before writing them off.
And I saw Joel Anderson make this point that, like, you rarely hear black HBCU graduates regret their decision to go to that school, right? Like, right. You ask me about Prairie View A&M University, I talk to you about it all day long. I loved it. Loved every moment. Best decision I ever made in my life. Ken, I know there's some HBCU graduates in your family. When you've talked to them about going to their HBCU, what have they said about it?
They love it. My mom went to Prairie View. My dad went to Texas Southern.
So I think my overall point here I'm trying to make on this end is that a lot of these big white schools, the fans and even these boosters and everybody's relationship with these black players, this is strictly transactional. This is strictly conditional. The moment you're not good anymore, they don't care. They're ready to send you out to pasture. At a historically black university, we really don't care. Like, whether you turn out to be a great football player, go to the NFL or not, we still gonna love you. We still gonna treat you like, you know, like you family.
Right.
It's not gonna be, oh, you threw three interceptions. No, you need to transfer. Get the fuck out of here. It ain't gonna be that. I also think that's what's also attracting a lot of people to the HBCU environment, is like the sense of family. And I was telling somebody this, that anytime I'm at Prairie View, it feels like home. It feels like I can be my true self because I'm at home. I always get the feeling that a lot of these guys go to these big schools almost because they felt like they had to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I have this, like, sneaky suspicion that if all things being equal, like, if the black schools had all of the funding and all of the financing and all the bells and whistles that the big schools would go to, that the big schools have, they would probably choose a historically black university. If everything was equal.
Yeah, Deion Sanders even said it. He said, I know that if everything was equal, you're going to go with me because you're my brother. You look like me and you talk like me. But the real challenge is, because it's not equal, I'm still going to find a way to get you to come play for me.
So we're going to leave it right there. And we are actually out of time here on the Game Plan Podcast. We're going to cut things just a touch short this week. But Kennedy Miller, my man, I appreciate you for hanging out with me each and every week. Where can the folks find you on Twitter and all your other social media platforms?
Find me on Twitter at _KennedyMiller_.
All right. You guys can follow me on Twitter at AlexGoodwinTSM. Again, that's on Twitter at AlexGoodwinTSM. That's T as in Tangare, S as in Stafford, M as in mother. All right, guys. So wherever you're listening and however you're listening, we appreciate you guys for listening. For Kennedy Miller, my name is Alex Goodwin. This has been the Game Plan Podcast, and we will see you guys next time.